Thank you so much, and thanks for having me here. So I want to talk about how we can use data-driven theoretical approaches to understand the dynamics of cell migration in confinement. And to get started, I would like to motivate this problem with a couple of examples that really got us thinking about this problem. So here you're looking at a white blood cell migrating through a three-dimensional extracellular matrix. For a cell to make its way effectively through such a structure, it has to constantly squeeze itself through the tight pores of this matrix. So the cell is facing these migratory challenges. And we want to understand how the cell really dynamically resolves migratory challenges in the form of these constrictions or tight pores. Another example here is shown by these collection of neutrophils that are making their way towards the site of inflammation. But to get there, these cells again have to squeeze through tight and long constrictions. Again, they're facing migratory challenges. Another feature that I think is very nicely highlighted by this example is that the cells are frequently encountering each other. So they undergo contact interactions, and these contact interactions can qualitatively impact the migratory dynamics of these cells. And we want to understand how such contact interactions can shape the larger scale dynamics of such systems, for instance, in the example of this 2D epithelium, or in 3D, in this example of a mammary cell organoid. So with this range of examples, I would like to illustrate that cells in these physiological or somewhat physiological contexts are really facing a whole range of different migratory challenges in the form of how they interact with their surrounding structured or confining environment, or how they interact with each other. And we want to figure out how we can conceptually think about how the cells dynamically respond to these challenges. Now, the approach I want to put forward to this is a dynamical systems approach. And I want to contrast it a little bit with some of the other approaches we've heard about in the conference this morning. So what we're not going to do is we're not going to start, for instance, with known properties of the active cytoskeletal material properties that were very elegantly demonstrated by some of the talks this morning. We're also not going to start from all the molecular details of how the different key components of the cytoskeletal or motility machinery interact with each other. What we're actually going to do is we're going to look at the more integrated, larger scale dynamical behavior that emerges at larger scale, the systems level functional dynamics of these cells. And our hope is that by observing this functional system level dynamics, that we can not only conceptually understand how we should think about the dynamics of cell migration, but hopefully also start connected to the specific molecular components of the underlying machinery. All right, so how are we going to do this? The general approach is a data-driven approach. The question I'm asking is whether we can actually learn such a dynamical description of cell migration directly from data. So our hope is that we can ultimately piece together all the important physics and biology that underlies the migration of a cell. And this is obviously a very hard question to answer. It's hard because it's not clear a priori which degrees of freedom to follow in such a system, or whether it would be a low-dimensional description. It is also hard because we would have to figure out a way to somehow disentangle the innate behavior, the single-cell behavior of a migrating cell, from how it couples to its environment or how it interacts with other cells. So to get started on answering this question, we want to use an approach that is as systematic and as simple as possible. So we're really going to start with the simplest possible case we could imagine, and then slowly add more complexity. So to do this, we teamed up with the lab of Joachim Redler in Munich. And in Joachim's lab, they can create these micro patterns. And we've seen a couple of examples of these micro patterns this morning. So the micro patterns from Joachim's lab are shown here in the sketch. The region in gray here is coated with fibronectin, which promotes the adhesion of the cell to the substrate. The region outside is coated with PEG, and this ensures that the cells are really effectively confined to move on this dumbbell-shaped region. If you plate a large collection of human breast cancer cells on these micro patterns, you can see that they are indeed effectively confined to this region, but they're very dynamic. So the cells repeatedly try to overcome this migratory challenge we created here, this constriction that they need to squeeze through. We can look at this in a bit more detail in this experiment here, which I think beautifully illustrates lots of different rich aspects about this problem. When looking at an experiment like this, you could, for instance, focus on the dynamics of the cytoskeletal organization underlying this confined migration problem. You could look at the dynamics of all the protrusions that are forming, small and large protrusions, or the shape dynamics of the whole cell. We're going to start by doing something as simple as possible. We're simply going to track the center of the nucleus over time to find a position time trajectory. And this very low dimensional representation of what's going on here captures some of the essential features of this confined migration problem. Now, you can do this for hundreds and hundreds of cells. These are all essentially identical cells trying to overcome the same migration challenge over and over again. And when you look at these data, you immediately recognize that there's a lot of inherent variability to this process. So if we're looking for a dynamical description of such a confined migration problem, this has to be a stochastic framework. So one of the candidate models that we started looking at is to find a stochastic equation of motion for such a confined cell. This is going to be a Langevin equation, and there's actually a whole range of different model structures we could consider here. And we actually systematically went through a whole range of different models, including models that would involve memory, as we heard about this morning. But in the end, we managed to converge to a relatively simple model structure where the acceleration of the cell is determined by a sum of two terms, a deterministic driving term that depends on the position and the velocity of the cell. And this deterministic driving term would encode how the cell is interacting with this confining geometry. In addition, there's a dynamical noise, a Gaussian white noise term. And here the presumption is, in analogy with problems such as Brownian motion, is that there is a separation of timescales. So this effect of noise somehow represents the integrated dynamics of all the fast molecular processes involved in motility, and the overall deterministic dynamics of the slow degree of freedom, the overall motion of the cell, is encoded by this deterministic driving term. Now, there's no reason a priori why a model like this should be correct. I cannot derive it from first principles. So at the moment, it is just a leap of faith. How do you test whether a model like this makes sense for such a confined migration problem? What we did is we used this large ensemble of trajectories and inferred, assuming this is the right model, the different terms in this equation of motion. And inferring such a stochastic equation of motion of this type is actually a very challenging problem. If you're interested in that, we offer an approach to do this in this recent PRL. Here I'm just going to show you the result, okay? So once you perform this inference, you can, for instance, determine this deterministic driving term. And it has lots of different structure. But before reading into it, we should again ask whether this model actually makes sense. You can do the inference assuming the model does, but how do you really test that it makes sense? So here, you should keep in mind that when doing the inference, you're using statistics of the short timescale processes, the instantaneous acceleration and velocity of the cell. Once you have inferred the model, you can simulate it, and you can simulate the hopping processes of these cells over time and make predictions for long timescale behaviors. And this is a prediction, then, that you can test against the data, because this is something you did not use to constrain the model. So we looked at all kinds of different statistics. There's a few I want to point out here, like the steady state probability for position or velocity, or the velocity autocorrelation function. And in all cases, the model does a reasonable job at predicting these statistics. It also captures the main timescale of this process, the time for the cell to hop from one side to the other, and it can do so as we vary the length of the bridge over about an order of magnitude. So this gives us some confidence that the simple equation of motion is capturing essential features of this confined migration problem. So the question is then, what can you learn from such a model, right? Well, one thing it tells us is the structure of the underlying nonlinear dynamics of this confined migration problem. And what it reveals, for instance, is that for this particular cell type, that these transitions from site to site are encoded by limit cycle oscillations. Another interesting feature that you can see from looking at the nonlinear dynamics of such a model is that in this position velocity phase space, there's a region here that corresponds to points on the trajectory where the cell is moving through this constriction. The cells are deterministically accelerating. And this was something that came as a surprise, because we had an initial conceptual picture for this problem where the constricting bridge was acting as an effective energy barrier. What this inferred model tells us is that that picture is wrong, right? Because for an energy barrier, you would expect the system to somehow deterministically slow down. Instead, there is this active squeezing behavior where the cells deterministically accelerate through this constriction. The moment you remove the constriction, this deterministic acceleration vanishes. You can also look at other cell types, like this non-cancerous MCF10A cells. They exhibit different kinds of nonlinear dynamics, now characterized by two stable attractors, but still you have this region in phase space where they're deterministically accelerating through this constriction. Okay? So what can this approach do? It offers a dynamical systems formalism to characterize confined cell migration. We use it, for instance, to look at problems like phenotypic heterogeneity in a large population of cells, how the cells respond to different geometries of the confinement, and we use it to learn something about the underlying mechanism. And I want to spend a little bit of time to talk about how a data-driven theoretical approach can ultimately give you insight into the underlying mechanism. So our claim is that once we inferred this model, it puts very strong constraints on what the underlying physical processes could be to lead to these kind of behavior. So this data-driven model offers a guide. Okay, so once we wanted to write down a more concrete physical model for this problem, we started considering models of this type where we describe the cell as an extended object, now with 2 degrees of freedom, one representing the nucleus, one somehow the leading edge of the protrusion, and all these different variables are coupled to each other in a very general model structure. Another variable that is very important here is the polarity, which is assumed to be some internal state of the system that drives the dynamics of the protrusions. Okay, so far this is a very general model and it doesn't teach you anything yet. So how could we actually go about constraining such a model using the data as a guide? To do this, we went again back to the data, but now looked at it with a bit more in a bit more detail. So we trained a convolution neural network to segment the cells in an automated fashion and to also give us not just the center of the nucleus over time, but also something like the center of mass of the protrusion. This gives us then an additional piece of information that could allow us to constrain a model of this type. So now we have pairs of trajectories of both the protrusion coordinate and the nucleus. So the philosophy is we can start by assuming a very general model structure and then use the data to fill in all the details. Okay? Now, to do that requires a very systematic inference scheme. I won't go into all the details about how we do that, but the main idea is that you piece together different parts of the model through an inference structure. And at the end of the day, you get a very explicit model with parameters that you can completely constrain by the data. Now, the biggest surprise of this model came when looking at the dynamics of this polarity that we inferred. So when the cells move just on the square islands, or whether they would move away from a confinement, the polarity dynamics is always exhibiting a negative feedback onto itself. So the polarity always wants to die out or decay. But the moment the cells move into the protrusion, we see that the sign of the feedback on this polarity changes. It goes from negative to positive feedback. And this can drive a symmetry breaking transition in this polarity variable that drives the protrusions through the constriction. Now, a mechanistic model like this is now completely constrained by the data and can make very specific predictions for what would happen if you change the geometry. Sorry, I think my slide is slightly getting messed up here, but the main idea is that it makes predictions for what would happen as you vary the dimensions of this pattern. You either lengthen the bridge or you change the width of the bridge. And the model makes very specific predictions about how the cells should behave that we can then test against the data. So unfortunately, the slide got messed up completely, and I can't show you the actual results, but please have a look at the preprint where we go through this in detail. Another thing that we're doing as we're further exploring this behavior is to take a closer look at the dynamics of the nucleus involved in this process. So now we're extending the micro patterns into 3D, where we can create a three-dimensional constriction that can be so narrow that it's actually hard for the nucleus to move through. And when doing that, we can then study how the nucleus is deforming as the cell is transitioning through this constriction. Another aspect that we're looking at the moment are cell-cell interactions. And this is something I want to spend a bit more time on. In this experiment here, you're looking at two MCF10A cells undergoing repeated collisions with each other. This collision behavior is very variable. There's different types of collisions. Sometimes we see the cells bumping pretty much head-on and then reversing their direction. Sometimes we see the cells sliding past each other. And occasionally we can see the cells kind of tailgating, following each other through the constriction. So these are very different types of collision behaviors that we just observe even in a single movie like this. So to look at this collision behavior in a bit more detail, and actually in full statistical detail, we again want to do a very large set of experiments where we can measure the trajectories of colliding cells, and we're going to do this for these two cell types in parallel, a cancerous and a non-cancerous human breast tissue cell type, and measure these trajectories. And when you look at them, at first glance, you might notice some similarities and some differences, right? And one of the most significant difference, I think, that you might note is differences in the occurrence of different types of collisions. So from these trajectories, you can simply count. Oof. So I'm really having some trouble with the slides here. Some of the graphs are simply not showing. Okay, let me just show you what you would see here. What we did is we counted the different types of collision behaviors, like how often they reverse upon collision, how often they slide past each other upon collision, how often they exhibit this tailgating. For the cancerous cell type, we find that they predominantly interact through sliding type collisions. For the non-cancerous cell type, they interact with each other predominantly through reversal type of transitions. And so the question is, can we figure out an underlying dynamical framework that can explain the differences and similarities between these different cells? Again, we try and find an equation of motion for these interacting cells. And we use a data-driven theoretical approach to identify the different terms in this equation. So the first term here is the one-body term. It explains how one of the cells in this pair is interacting with the confining geometry. And here we found a very big surprise. If we do this inference for these cells, the structure of the one-body term is almost identical for what we observed for these cells when they're just moving by themselves on the pattern. So this means that the presence of the other cell is not affecting how a given cell interacts with its confining geometry. Okay? It didn't have to be that way. It would be possible that the cell actually adapts to the presence of the other cell. So the presence of the other cell really manifests in terms of these interaction terms, which we could narrow down to relatively simple interaction times. One that couples to the relative separation between the cells, which you can think of as a cohesive-like interaction, and one that couples to the relative velocity between these cells, which you can think of like a friction-like interaction. Now, when we do the inference, we can, for instance, also determine the prefactors in front of these terms, which depend on the relative separation of these cells. When we do this for the MCF10A cells, what you would have seen if the graph would have shown here is that the prefactor for the delta X term, so this F of delta X, is positive, and it peaks at a certain length scale. So this is a repulsive type of interaction. For the prefactor of the delta V term, we would find that it's negative everywhere and also peaks at a given length scale. So this is what you would expect for a friction-like interaction. Now, if you do the same kind of inference for the cancer cell type, we saw something very different. The structure of these two interaction terms is different. There's now an attractive cohesive-like interaction combined with a negative friction. So the sign of the friction-like term changes. Okay? And this came as a bit of a surprise. Now, I apologize for these graphs not showing up. I hope my description is sufficiently clear. Let me just go to the next one. So with such a model, again, you have to test that once you did this inference, that the model can make reasonable predictions. Right? So one of the predictions this model had to get right is the relative occurrence of these different kinds of collisions, which it gets right. You can also look at all kinds of other statistics on long timescales, and these models are surprisingly accurate at capturing those statistical behaviors. The main idea of this inferred model is summarized here in what we like to call an interaction behavior space. So it's spanned by the two interaction terms in the model, the strength of the friction-like term and the strength of the cohesion-like term. And depending on where you are in this phase space, we see different dominant behavior. So in the lower right quadrant, where we encountered the non-cancerous cell type, we see a dominance of these reversal type of collisions. And this is reminiscent of cell-cell interaction behavior that is termed contact inhibition of locomotion. So we think that the dominant behavior of this quadrant of the interaction behavior space simply reflects contact inhibition of locomotion. The cancer cell type we actually observed in the opposite quadrant of this interaction behavior space, where the dominant behavior is very different. Here we see a dominance of the sliding behavior. So we term this contact sliding of interactions, or contact sliding of locomotion. In the lower left quadrant, here we actually didn't encounter a single cell, but we see a dominance of following type interactions. And this has actually been observed for other cell types in other contexts, which was termed contact following of locomotion. So what we hope is that with this interaction behavior space, we can provide a more unified description to capture different types of cell-cell collision behaviors within the same framework. We can also gain some mechanistic insight by taking a closer look at the collision behavior of the non-cancerous MCF10A cells. So these are cells for which contact inhibition of locomotion is probably the dominant interaction between these colliding cells. A lot is known about the underlying mechanism for contact inhibition of locomotion in these cells. So then we try to see whether we can systematically perturb these kind of collision behaviors and try and capture those perturbations within this framework. So what we did is we're now going to compare the behavior of these regular MCF10A cells. Now you can actually see the graphs I wanted to show you earlier, where you see the different interaction terms that we inferred and how they predict the relative collisions. And now I want to contrast that with what you would see for the same cell types if you block EEC adherence. So here we used antibodies to block EEC adherent, and you see that there's a big difference in the type of collisions that are dominating. It's shifting from reversal type collisions towards sliding type collisions. If you do the inference, you see that the interaction terms have a different structure. So these molecular perturbations directly influence the interactions between these cells. The result of this, if you go back to the interaction behavior space, is that when we started somewhere in the lower right quadrant for these MCF10A cells, that upon performing this molecular perturbation, you see that the behavior of the cell shifts somewhere else in this interaction behavior space. We saw something similar by blocking efferent A2s, another central component for contact inhibition of locomotion. So we're using this approach to try and gain more insight in the underlying molecular mechanism of contact inhibition of locomotion. So I'm trying to wrap up now, just one last slide to show you the outlook. We've mostly focused on sort of one cell behavior and two cell behavior. The next step in this process is to look at collective dynamics of cells, such as these multicellular spheroids. We're studying how the interactions between these cells within this curved confined geometry gives rise to collective behavior in these systems. And let me just end on my acknowledgement slide, especially to mention David, Alexandra, Tom, and Johannes, who have really been the leading students in driving this project. And I also would like to mention my collaboration with Joachim Reger's lab, who was providing most of the experimental data I showed you. Thank you very much.